You're not uncomfortable sitting on the Senate side, are you?
Not at all.
Good morning. Welcome to the Tuesday, May 4th edition of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Natural Resources Subcommittee. We are hearing House Bill 5023, the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Mr. Greer, the director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, is in the process of giving us an overview of the agency. Mr. Greer, good morning, and we're ready to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Jim Greer, director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I had several questions yesterday, and I thought that it might be best for several of them, particularly related to the fisheries program or the Oregon plan, to recently had our fish division director, Doug DeHart, maybe answer those. I've got some preliminary answers for you, but I think it might generate some additional questions, so we could probably wait for those. On the one that Representative Meserly asked yesterday relative to surplus property, I do have some information I could share now with the committee if you'd like. Otherwise, I have to jump right back into the overview.
Mr. Greer, that'll be just fine. And as far as Mr. DeHart responding to questions about the Fish Department, the Fish Section.
Good point. So would you like me to do a quick overview of the surplus property question?
Sure, absolutely.
Simply, Mr. Chair, what we have is many small pieces of property across the state. And I think, Representative Meserly, you had a copy of a printout or at least a summary of all of those different properties. And we listed somewhere in the neighborhood of 357,000 acres. Our realty program took a look at those actually a few months ago to see what we had in terms of surplus property. And I wanted to be sure that we were all on kind of the same page in terms of a definition of how we would proceed for the surplus property. The way we took a look at it is we said the surplus property is essentially no longer needed for public use or whenever the public interest may be furthered by the sale or exchange or to convey the property itself or any lease that's associated to it. Anything that essentially doesn't promote or meet some of our long-term goals and objectives. So we put together a relatively short list of properties that we felt did not meet that. I think it's interesting in terms of the overview, we found there was quite a few that were leases or conservation easements. There were some that were just easements, and we've actually listed those as properties that we have on our books that we don't necessarily own, so they're not all fee title. But we came up with about 9 different properties that we felt would serve as surplus property to the state. Most all of them have no deed restrictions on them, but we're actively looking for trades or new acquisitions that we could utilize these properties to get closer to what our long-term goals are. A high percentage of the purchases that have been made in the past have been used with federal funds, and if we then sell those properties at a later time, those federal dollars have to go back to whatever agency actually gave those to us.
Sure.
Question from Representative Morgan, Mr. Chair.
Jim, my question is, how did these come into the possession of ODF&W, and what was the purpose for the department to get ownership of them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, many of these properties go way back. I was looking at our Eel Lake property, which is down on the lakeside area on the coast. That came to us back in the 1940s. And a lot of that property early on was purchased with the belief that it was going to be good habitat or it was going to be good recreational opportunities. Many of these smaller pieces have actually been donated to the agency. We recently accepted a 70-acre tract along the Nehalem River by a family that wanted to have our agency manage it. It was also an access point for fishing opportunities. And those fit right in with our goals. If we're going to provide more access to the rivers where we don't have good bank or boat angling access, and we get some habitat in a riparian corridor, those really do meet our goals and objectives, and we're simply accepting them on behalf of a donor. And we'll still pay in lieu of taxes, so that's something we have to look at in our overall program goals and objectives, but they come to us by many different avenues and over a long period of time. The majority of the larger purchases, and we're talking about hundreds of thousands of acres, we were in the 40s, 50s, and 60s on a major buying venture as an agency. We picked up Summer Lake Wildlife Area in the 40s. That was probably over 12,000 acres at the time, and we've added to that in terms of marsh management. It's really important to have some of those areas adjacent to it, some of the original purchases. Many of them are associated to reducing damage components, like in the Elkhorn Valley in Baker County, where we had elk and deer coming off the Elkhorn Mountains into the valley during the winter months. And we essentially purchased some key feeding sites around the base of the mountains, and those were used to essentially pull those animals back off of the ag lands, and we were able to manage and hold a higher population in those mountain areas without impacting the lower agricultural areas. So, and then on the fisheries side, we have dollars from the Wallabro or Dingle Johnson Fund, which is the excise tax on angling equipment. That has allowed us to essentially look for areas for access and for fishing along different rivers, and it's really kind of a mixed bag. But it's focused on recreational activities. Earlier purchases were focused on reducing damage complaints, and then essentially protecting key fishing wildlife habitats. So these, I might just give it to Representative Meserly. He's looked at our list. We've come up with 8 different holdings. They're not very large in size. They range anywhere from 5 or 6 acres up to 421 acres of some river access areas that right now don't seem to provide the same kind of access that we've needed in the past. 54, 28 acres. Many of them are unimproved boat ramp currently. We had formerly river and pond access that right now doesn't seem to be meeting some of our goals and objectives. So I might just give it to Representative Netherland, and if you have some follow-up questions, we'd be glad to answer those.
Okay. Appreciate it. Mr. Chair? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Greer, did I hear you say that of the properties you own, you pay in lieu of taxes?
That's correct.
On all the properties you own?
Yes.
And is there been a study? I understand your interest, the department's interest in having a property for access to hunting and fishing. Couldn't you do that with easements rather than owning the property?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Meserly, many of the properties that we actually have some sort of interest in is a lease or an easement of some kind. They're not all fee title.
Chair, if I could follow up with another statement. I think we very quickly get into the discussion of whether property is managed better with private or public ownership. And even though it's a habitat area, I think there's examples of where public ownership does not necessarily mean that land is managed better or cheaper. And I don't know what the policy that your department is today. Sounds like you've had a policy in the past of purchasing a lot of property. But I think maybe there needs to be a review of what it means to be publicly owned and what how does the public benefit and what does it cost the general fund. The taxes that you pay, how do you pay those taxes? Is that out of general fund money?
It's pretty much all out of program dollars. So, just an example, White River Wildlife Area, which is on the east slope of Mount Hood, and again, that's another area that we've purchased along the edge of agricultural lands to keep those animals out of the valley bottom. So those dollars come straight from the Pittman-Robertson Fund, again, which is excise tax on hunting, arms, and ammunition. And then we offset the 25% match with our license dollars.
Chair, could I follow up on your question? What is the dollar amount that your department pays in lieu of taxes every year?
I could sure try to nail that down for you. I haven't got that today, but I'm sure our realty office has got that. Because with all of these properties, I don't know that we've actually done any kind of a total of all of them, but we could sure take a look at it and give you a close approximation of that.
Mr. Greer, on that paper that you were going to get to me, maybe Mr. Rocker can pull you over here. Make copies for everyone, sir.
Exactly.
Way ahead of me.
Mr. Chair. Richard Fulton has a question.
In a case of donations of property, how often do we get, let's say, like the chunk along the hailing? Is it very often?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, it's not real often. I think in the last 2 years, we've only had to deal with a couple of properties, maybe two, maybe a property a year. So it's not a real normal occurrence.
Let me understand, then. If you have a piece of property donated to you, you're going to have to assume the property tax. Then you're going to have to assume some sort of maintenance and upkeep on that piece of property. And that all has to come from your general fund dollars?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, no. Our programs will look at where those are going to come from. And like you say, we have to build in some sort of a maintenance program for any property we hold, and that will often determine whether or not we'll accept or reject an offer or a donation. We really pull it right from the dollars come right from the program under which that would be managed by. So the fish program is probably going to come under our Wallabro, generally our federal program. But I don't believe we have any general fund dollars that we're spending on those properties right now.
Thanks.
Question, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While it might not be general fund dollars, it would seem to me off of the properties that we own that the properties themselves ought to generate sufficient money from rent or crop or product or something to pay for the space of the taxes and maintenance and upkeep on it. In the event that they don't, if it comes out of fishing license or something else, is that not robbing Peter to pay Paul? Are we not taking money away from something we might use somewhere else at some other important place to pay property taxes?
Representative Jensen, we do get a small amount of money off of some of those properties. Some of it's in the case of barter. There are some straight payments where we do continue to graze cattle for benefit of wildlife, so we'll see some income off of those properties. I guess I should remind folks that in the case of a very large purchase of several thousand acres like we had our White River Wildlife Area, the purchase itself was done with a tremendous amount of partnership dollars. The Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation came in and essentially purchased the majority of that land for us. So there was really not a total out-of-pocket expense from the hunters and anglers. Funds. And in some cases, we actually just set up an easement, so there is a one-time payment, and we don't have a lot of continuing payments over time. But where we can, we'll still generate a small amount of money, or we'll work with cooperatives that are actually on that piece of land to get maintenance work done in lieu of, say, a fee for cattle grazing or something like that.
I have a question, Mr. Greer. Does your agency have any of the properties that are currently that was purchased from the Nature Conservancy or any other nonprofits like the Public Trust or et cetera?
Have we purchased from those?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I don't think we purchased from them, but we may have partnered up with them to get a piece of property. But I don't believe we've actually purchased outright from some existing conservation group like that. I think they're more in the sense that we'll have a cooperative partner like the foundation of Ducks Unlimited or something like that would come in and help purchase the property. And then sometimes we'll find, like through the BPA mitigation program, where BPA is providing dollars for us to try to find matching money to the purchased land to mitigate for the Columbia River dams, we may actually turn the management of the property over to another entity. They may have the better facilities to do it, or they have programs that are next door or close by that they can actually do the maintenance for us, and we'll work out an agreement of some kind like that.
And is the list that you that we're having copies of the members, it did have the current estimated value?
Yeah. And I'm not sure what the date of that estimated value is, but it's the most current that we have in our book.
Thank you. That's been possible.
You're looking down here. You got D.A. Young, unimproved boat ramp on the Umpqua. Why haven't you worked with Marine Board to improve that boat ramp? Is there a reason?
I can't give you the specific reason for that. We can ask the Fish Division. I'm guessing on some of these, and I've seen where there's been an improved boat facility nearby or close by that was replaced the one that is unimproved, so we really don't have a need to have that ongoing to put dollars into it because we've got another one close by. It's in better shape.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would it be possible for our committee to request details on those relationships that have been established, the actual agreements that are between them, properties that are identified that they're partnering on?
Mr. Garrett, could we request copies of any deed restrictions or intergovernmental agreements or scholar agreements with the agency so you see what kind of restrictions if there were donations?
Sure. Could I bring like a sample of those in? We have hundreds of these very small properties that might be very different, but maybe give you some a sense of some of the different options we've got in terms of agreements and so forth.
If there's a single book that has all those in there, that would be good to have the whole book.
Is there a central repository of such information, Mr. Green?
There is a printout that we have that has all of our holdings in it. Holdings, easements, leases, those kinds of things. Yes.
Is it significant and voluminous?
Yes, it's significant and voluminous, yes.
Okay. I guess I was was not aware that the agency was such a large landowner. Do you have an idea about how many
properties? It's large in number, not in size, but we have, one stream system may have many, many boat access, as an example.
Senator Gregg, would you want to have the printout and take a look at it?
I'd like to see,
and see if that brings you to a place where you may have further questions to bring to the committee.
But it may be a case, too, if, you know, it's something we could have the committee staff be in charge of that, we could come to look at it.
We could do that. I'm pretty jealous of committee staff time. So,
just hold it in their hand. That would be awesome.
Actually, if we could have a copy for reference for the committee members.
While you're gathering the information on the taxes that the agency pays, could you also bring us a summary on what the management costs and the maintenance costs are for the department to own those properties?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mesley, why don't you try to carve that down to some sort of maybe on a category basis? In other words, it'd be very different for each property that we own. So if you look at our 12 facilities where we have personnel on site, those are fairly large, so the maintenance would be much higher at those than it might be for one like in the Hill and Boat site I was mentioning earlier. Maybe we can break down the categories for you to give us some estimates of what it means to maintain a certain kind of property.
Obviously, what I'm looking for is the total cost of ownership. And if you could break that down, it would be even better.
Questions for the Senator?
How many boat sites do you own around the state? Do you have any idea how many the main board owns? And why are we having it in two different areas?
Two different areas. What do you mean by
that? What I mean, the main board owns a bunch of boat ramps, and we own a bunch of boat ramps. They're both boat ramps. Why are we...
In fact, Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, we do cooperate on a number of those boat ramps with the Marine Board. In fact, actually use some of the Marine Board dollars to improve or put in some of the boat ramps that we own. I thought I might turn to the former Fish Division person. Do you have an idea, Rich, how many we might have just ballpark across the state?
A lot of them are donated specifically for those purposes. I think that might be...
We'll sure bring those back. I think we can give you an overall estimate, at least, of what we've got for boat ramps, specifically, and maybe angler access points. I think we've broken those out on some of the computer printouts right now. Well, I think we left on page 9. I think we wrapped up page 9 yesterday in terms of our overview, looking at the revenue composition and outlook summary. If I would start on the next page, page 10, which essentially starts talking about what we see as a forecast, particularly in the other fund dollars. We have a small table here on page 10 that gives you the projections that we've made to determine what we feel will have for license and tag revenues in this coming biennium, 9901. And it shows how it's broken down by the actual license and tag revenues of $51.1 million. And then there's some existing surcharges that have been on the books now for several years. Fish Recreation Enhancement generates approximately $6.4 million. Fish Screening, which was a 25-cent surcharge on the angling license a couple of years ago, is generating about $400,000 a year. And then the Access and Habitat Board, which was created in 1993, initiated in 94, generates approximately $1.2 million off of the surcharge itself. So you see the total amount of surcharge dollars is approximately $8 million. And then where we are projecting or we are asking for through the governor's recommended budget a license fee increase of approximately $7 plus million, the total generated then for the 9901 budget period would be $66.5 million. At the bottom, it gives you a little bit more information on where some of the other sources are for our other funds. It includes the commercial fishing industry fees that were actually being projected for 9901 in terms of a downward trend. We're seeing those drop off.
Let me back up for just a second. The proposed increase in angler fees, license fees, we had a decrease in the cost of hunting fees for cougar tags. And it was my impression that cougar tag sales have significantly increased. And then overall revenues are on the sales of tags. Can you describe that curve and compare it with what you're proposing for fishing licenses?
I think the issue that you speak to on the cougar tags is one that it's a phenomenon that I think is relative to the increasing population in cougars and the widespread media attention to those increases. We're particularly seeing these animals moving into more populated areas down the valley floors. We're getting many more damage complaints than we've had in the past. A couple of years ago, we suggested because we had a limited opportunity to hunt cougars because of Measure 18 took away the ability to use hounds, which is the most effective means for hunting cougars, to try to make tags more available, we actually expanded our season time frames as well. In some portions of the state, we've had nearly a year-round season. So it was an attempt to take a look at how available a hunter might have a tag in his pocket. So during the deer and the elk seasons where there are some of these animals seen, if we had a license fee priced at a much lower level, they might be more inclined to purchase that tag. The availability of the tag was much more, the time frame, we often have a tag sale deadline. These tags are much more available now to the general hunter. And we did see a considerable increase in those sales. Prior to Measure 18, we were issuing tags on a controlled hunt basis so that we were probably seeing around 400 or 500 tags issued on an average year, with a harvest somewhere in the neighborhood of 140 to 150 animals. Once that Measure 18 imposed a loss of dogs on the hunters, we immediately saw the harvest fall back, and we had, at that time, a $50 license fee. Well, a couple of years ago, we asked for a reduction in that fee of $10 to see if that would actually attract hunters to buying those tags and having them with them so that if they did see a cougar in some of these more populated areas, they could take that animal. We went from, what I mentioned earlier, maybe 400 or 500 tag sales up to over 10,000 in that short period of time. I think we'll probably see a drop-off in those sales. A lot of folks put those tags in their pockets in the hopes of seeing a cougar. They're extremely elusive animals, so you're not going to see them on a regular basis. We had a higher take on our harvest this last year, and we're now getting back up to where we saw some of the original sport harvest levels in the 120 to 150 range. But I got a hunch we're going to see a falling off of those sales over time as people find maybe it's just not that easy to find a cougar out in the woods. But because of the media attention, I think that really spurred those sales. So even though we have a small number of tags originally, and we've now cranked them up by almost tenfold, the actual income is relatively small to what you might have in terms of what we're proposing here as a very small increase to a license or tag fee of a couple of dollars to $5 on a deer and elk tag, which generates many more dollars for the agency just simply because of the numbers. We have probably close to 300 hunters, maybe 150,000 deer and elk hunters. The dollars generated will be much higher than what we saw in terms of the new dollars coming into the agency because of the reduction of the cougar tag. I'm not sure if that's getting your question, but...
Sure, it is getting to the question. I guess what I'm suggesting is that for whatever reason, you made a net increase in revenue to the department because of a decrease in tag sales, or tag cost to the public. And I guess the corollary is every dollar you increase, or every dollar which you increase in a tag or license fee, you lose a corresponding number of sports people. I just wondered if there was a clear connection in the department's analysis of the proposed increase. You know, declining revenue gives you several opportunities. You can increase opportunities. You can increase service. You can add value to the product. You can reconfigure. And I'm wondering how much of that has been thought through before we've gotten to the place where we're asking more money from the same population, or in fact a fewer number of anglers and hunters.
That all went into our analysis in terms of what we felt was an average increase, or a moderate increase, I should say, relative to what we've seen and how the dollars were generated over the last many years, and how many people actually participated in that recreational activity. It's pretty clear that we've lost anglers over time, and we've lost anglers from a number of areas. The steelhead tag is one where we've seen a tremendous amount of drop-off. The daily license is another place where we've seen a large drop-off, primarily because of coastal fisheries, where we just don't see the activity in the charter boat industry that we saw in the past. In those areas, we're probably going to have a difficult time in terms of getting folks back into the fishing hole, so to speak. But I don't think we'll see quite the downturn in terms of the overall sales of fishing licenses like we talked yesterday. I think we are into that area now where there are folks that aren't going to give up fishing, and our job is going to be to make sure that they have the information necessary to find out where those fishing opportunities still exist and they're still good. And there still are good fishing opportunities on the coast. We still have a good Chinookan in the Rogue River. We have some good opportunities in the Columbia. Sturgeon is becoming a very popular fishery, and it's probably going to be a replacement fishery for salmon and steelhead. So I think it's incumbent upon us to make sure that we get that information out. Part of the license fee increase that we talked about yesterday, a small amount, is for enhancement work such as restoring Diamond Lake, which would generate hundreds of recreational days as opposed to the thousands that it's dropped to just in recent years because of the competition between the Tui Chub and Rainbow Trout. So I think all of those things came into our considerations for how high should we raise this license fee and what portion of that license fee should address our shortfall as opposed to the general fund, which we had a considerable discussion on the other day, that we believe the rest of the community, the rest of the state citizens who don't hunt or fish also have a great advantage by having these species in their state and should also contribute to the management of them long term.
Do we do any consultation with
recreational industry folks or folks in marketing or market development outside the agency when we develop the increased proposal?
When we developed the increased proposal, we did have input from all of those industries that were associated to our activities. Going to a professional marketer, I don't think we did that in the early going. We relied a lot of our information was from our own economist, who is connected to all those sources as well. So we have that outreach, and we have that information, but we generally use that through an in-house process.
When you were doing your feasibility studies on raising the license and tag fees, did you also do studies on the effects of lowering the fees?
We didn't do studies per se, Representative Morgan, but we do know, essentially through our economists, what that might do overall in terms of other experiences and how you might raise or lower a tag or a license fee. I could ask Chris Carter, he is our economist, to maybe give you a quick overview of what would happen if we actually lowered our fees. That is something we've looked at pretty closely. Mike, just a quick overview by Mr. Carter.
I'd be interested in hearing the kind of reasoning into it.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Chris Carter, staff economist for the department. Mr. Chairman, Representative Morgan, when we consider fee increases are suggested, as they were in the last session, part of House Bill 3700, my job is to look at the response, try to estimate the response of people in terms of purchases of licenses and tags to those fee increases. Over the years, I've done a number of statistical analyses and read a number of pieces of information, tried to model these sales responses. And the bottom line to most of this is that in most cases you will see a reduction in sales, but the reduction in sales is less than the percentage increase in the amount of revenue, or the revenue that comes in. In other words, the demand for for licenses and tags, for the most part, is what's called inelastic in the jargon of economics. And that means the percentage decrease in the sales of tags is less than the percentage increase in the fee. Therefore, total revenues tend to increase in most cases. I have some tables that I brought with me in case you're interested. I think a number of the members of the committee have seen them.
Mr. King has a question.
Here's one point I just would like to... Oh.
I have a number of them.
No, no. We're doing great.
Just waving at the chair. Is that what we're doing?
I'll be there at one time.
Hello.
You're having a good morning.
But I have a number of tables here that, with your permission, Mr. Chairman, I could give to the committee staff to hand out. Here's some tables, too. These are a little easier to look at than these tables, but the graphs for about five major types of licenses and tags have kind of the sales history and what's happened when we raise fees.
And just for personal clarification, the basis of the data is ODF&W historical data?
Right.
Okay.
I think this is a classic example of diminishing returns, isn't it? Where the two curves cross.
These, Mr. Chairman, the where the curves cross, actually on the left axis, the revenues are plotted. Those are the bars or the columns that stick up in the air. The line that's connected is actually shows the sales, unit sales of the particular license or tag. And you can see in most cases, whereas we do see some drop off when fees are increased in terms of sales, we generally produce an increase in revenue. I don't think that means that we should raise fees willy-nilly. The idea, I think, is to keep people hunting and fishing, and if fees are a significant factor, which they are, then we need to be very careful about raising those fees. But the bottom line of all the statistical work that I've done in the graphical analyses is that when you raise a fee, you tend to get a drop-off in sales but an increase in revenue. And basically, except for specific cases like the Cougar tag, I believe that you will see a reduction in revenue if you lower most fees. The thing that's been hurting us so much in recent years, particularly on the fish side, of course, is the reduction in opportunity, the reduction in salmon and steelhead populations, and tightening of regulations inland. On the wildlife side, probably the biggest factor that we've had that's tended to hold down our sales has been when we went full limited entry on the east side for deer hunting in 1991. So that's basically the bottom line. There are many other things that influence sales of hunting and fishing licenses and participation. There's a good book that just came out called Wildlife in the American Mind. And in that book, there are a number of reasons that are based on survey research nationally that suggest why there have been reductions in participation, not only in Oregon, but nationwide. I do have a copy of...
Can I ask another question?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morgan here.
We're getting some information that appears to indicate that the ocean conditions are turning around and that we can expect higher returns of salmon-type fish from the ocean, which would indicate increased opportunities for fishing. Is there any way to factor into this statistical analysis the increase in possibilities?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morgan, yes, there is. I do have as an explanatory variable in the fishing license and tag equation a couple of different measures of either salmon catch or salmon steelhead trips or total salmon steelhead catch, and it shows a significant positive correlation. And when you look at what's happened to particularly sales of daily licenses and salmon tags, you can see that it tracks the allowable catch that we've had in the ocean fishery during the earlier El Nino that took place in 82 and 83, we had a dramatic drop-off, and I think you can probably see it in those tables. Probably the second, not the graphic, but the one with all the numbers on it.
I can't read.
It's kind of hard to read. But basically, if you look back to... I think the second table in has all the fish stuff on it. If you look at the sales of both daily line anglers, which is about in the eighth row, seventh or eighth row down, and you look at 1982, 83, 84, you can see where, particularly with salmon steelhead tags, we dropped from about nearly 300,000 in the early 80s. Down to 223,000 in 1983.
Which line are you looking at?
This is in the
Daily Angler.
Daily Angler and also Angling Tags. Angling Tags is probably the clearest one. It's about two-thirds of the way down the page.
Okay.
And under the bold heading Angler Tags, there's a licensing type called Salmon Steelhead Tag, and it's... You follow that across from the left to the right, and you get to 1982, 83, and 84, which was the previous El Nino that we had. You can see that those just dropped off because the seasons were essentially shut down, particularly in 84, but also in 83, they were very restrictive also. Then in the late 80s, as you moved into the late 80s, and we had a resurgence, you can see how those... tag sales picked up again, and in fact, daily license sales picked up again too. Until recently, and this era, early to mid 90s, has been very poor, very significant reductions in sales.
Okay, so I have another question. Is it possible then, based on some predictions that you have for return runs, to extend the spreadsheet out and correlate it to the revenue numbers, is in the raised license fee and the same license fee, and show us what it looks like?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morgan, I believe that would be possible. I think the difficulty is trying to project what kind of seasons and catch we're going to have.
Is there any basis to do that with any kind of relevancy?
Personally, I'm confident to answer that question. Yeah, there is. You got yourself a dartboard here in the back of the room.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morgan, I agree with Representative Thompson. It's very difficult. We do have the constraint on wild fish harvest now because what cohort listed, I think Doug DeHart will get into that one.
Actually, the appropriate answer to that question is, you want to buy a boat?
Yeah.
A lot of guys will ask.
It's very difficult. I believe if wild fish recover and we're able to get on hatchery fish again, either because we're going into this mass marketing program or just because of the overall health improvement, that we'll see a dramatic increase as we did in the late 80s. But when that will happen... It's the
$64 question. Mr. Chair. We have Representative Singh and then Representative Thompson.
In your hatchery statement, I think, is relevant. I do want to argue with the model some. And I know that your model is valid, but that's yesterday why I was concerned about, a historical sine curve with the possibility that we're running into a J curve. Because the historical data is based upon pre-ESO. Now we're in an ESA environment, and now we also have severe limitations in terms of the hatchery. So now I think that it is a new dimension, and we probably don't have any basis for really valid modeling. So I think that put back to you making a best estimate, a best guess on it. And I think there's another side to it besides just what's the best way to get the most revenue. Because if we're being a merchant, if we're vending a fish experience, an opportunity to catch a fish, we also have to be kind of fair in the process. And we do have some question about doubling the price for
a product that isn't as good as what it was. Now, if we're indeed, selling a product based upon, you have the opportunity to make a charitable contribution to help save the family in the future, then, that's a little different representation. So, going back to your question, can you do a model? Yeah, there are models for the past, but I'm not sure that the past statistical model works. I think it's still, and this chart shows it, that we are in a place where we're concerned where we're in the first stages of the J curve.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Keene, I think your points are valid. In fact, in any statistical analysis, when you project beyond the limits of the data, there's always a great deal of uncertainty. If the change in fees is fairly modest, I think there's some reason to expect that you won't see some really unusual reactions. Now, I don't have many. I think I have one copy of it, but I just recently had the chance to get the preliminary 1998 data on license sales. And you remember that as a result of House Bill 3700, we had increases in the surcharges on most angling licenses. And in fact, part of that money goes to the Watershed Improvement Grant Fund, part of the Oregon plan. It turns out that my projections were fairly close. I over-projected the dropout of combination license sales. It was just about right on for resident angler license sales. Under-projected the dropout in terms of daily license sales. So there could be some room for adjustments, I think, as new information becomes available. But I'd be glad to share that information with you. That's basically in this last year is when we've been under the conditions that you referred to in terms of being in a depressed state. So they're real interesting to look at.
If I could just follow it, and I don't think you took my case as being critical. I certainly didn't mean to be that way. I just wanted us to, be understanding that we are in a different environment for projecting what the revenues are going to be than what we had been up until perhaps somewhere in the last year.
Thank you, Representative Chair. I wish you a nice morning and question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All your graphs show a decline in sales of the license. And I'm concerned, and this is based partly on the feedback I get as a representative, the difficulty of and not so much the loss of opportunity because of less fisheries, because I think we still have many good fishing opportunities, but the difficulty of knowing when, how, what gear to use, and this type of thing. A lot of calls that I just give up. It's not worth taking a chance of being embarrassed or getting told they're out of compliance when they really weren't aware that they were really trying hard to be in compliance. And so is there a way that you can factor that into your figures, number one? And I guess I'm interested in what the department is doing in trying to advertise, spotlight the fisheries we do have and simplify it so that people can understand the right way and the less confusing, less restrictive way of doing the fisheries. As an example, on the Coquille River, and this isn't entirely Oregon's fault, because National Marine Fisheries Service had the ruling of 50% hatchery fish. But when the department is putting less hatchery fish into the system, so you don't have 50%, so that means that you can't, although we have a good return on the coho, there's a whole fisheries that was lost there, I believe. And partly because the department did not do the data, have the data to where they could go whether they had 50% of the hatchery stocks or not. These kind of lost opportunities, I think, we have to become very serious about. And we can't simply say that because of National Marine Fisheries Service listings, we're losing our fisheries opportunities. I think there's much more to the story than that. And so I guess that my question would be twofold. Number one, can you track that? Can you identify that in any way? And number two, is what is the department doing about it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nesserly, I think in terms of the statistical models that I do, it's about the limits of the limited amount of data, again, are related to catch as a kind of a proxy for resource conditions or number of trips taken in the past to see how the response to sales go. nothing as precise as changes in regulation are built into the models, with the exception on the wildlife side. You can build in what are known as indicator variables or dummy variables that capture a major shift in regulation changes, such as shifting to full limited entry on east side deer. But that has a significant effect. But in terms of trying to capture smaller changes in regulations, one, it's pretty hard to pick up the historical data to do it. And second, how to characterize that in a numerical way is real difficult. So I think when you use these models, you have to exercise judgment, too, and understanding. And they're not perfect. They're just kind of a guide to looking at what kind of revenue increases we can get. But I agree with your point completely in terms of the subtleties and the intricacies of the whole problem.
I guess I'm going to recognize the Western Council, and then we're going to make an offer to the committee of a different approach to this question. Western Council.
I want to expand the situation that exists this year. I'm trying to answer your question a little bit in a different manner and what's going on. We had an opportunity, and the numbers show about 660,000 cove hogs returning. And politically, there's this factor in this whole maze of things that we can't put our hands on, because politically it changes so much. We were only allowed through the Regional Management Council to harvest 15,000 of those. So you can see if we change that number from 15 to 30, or maybe if we were able to take 100,000 of those fish, we'd have a lot more license sales. Is there a way you can create a model that we can use to show what the difference in the dollars would be generated, let's say, at 100,000 fish, of that 600,000 returning fish, if we could harvest those, so we can show what the revenue would be, the loss of income to the state, because those fish should have been harvested in my mind. You know, we paid for them, they're tagged, they're marked, so they're easily identifiable from the natural resource fish, and they're not harvested, I think it's going to be a crime to this state.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thompson, that's correct. I do have that factor at least built into my model of license and tag sales. So I believe I can project an increase in license and tag sales based on increased ocean salmon catch and see what that squirts out. I haven't done that, but I believe I'd be glad to do that.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to see those numbers. If you could just don't go to a lot of trouble. If you could squirt out a number, if we could have harvested, we're going to be allowed to harvest 15,000 fish. If we could know what it would have been if we could have harvested 100,000 fish or 200,000 fish,
sure,
we'd have some idea if we would have got a fair shot at those fish.
Thanks to you, Representative Thompson. We're going to put Mr. Carter to an extraordinary amount of trouble, and that's the offer that I'm going to make to the committee. We are getting far afield from our intention of moving through this budget as an overview process. However, there is a fee bill in Ways and Means that has not yet been assigned to this committee. And it may be that what we would like to do is have the fee bill assigned to the committee, and outside the budgetary process for the agency, hold a hearing before this committee on the fee bill. And that way we can have to see there at least 8 Monday morning quarterbacks here. We can hear into the fee bill, and everybody has a theory. We'll push forward through that information to start and help us achieve some understanding about how the agency got here. Mr. Greer can help inform us about the policies. And Representative Thompson, I'd like to invite you to go ahead and stay with the committee through that process if you'd like to join.
If it's possible. I'm doubling committees right now, so I would love to.
Hey, forget that other
stuff. The other one's only 700.
What was the other bill? I think we need to stay here. So with the committee's approval, what we'll do is go ahead and ask for that other bill, and that way we can look more at the agency overview and move through and stay on our schedule for the overview process, and then we will get that hearing on what is the Senate Bill 21 and the we think, but we'll find out what it is and ask the full Ways and Means to plan for our committee. So if we could move off the fee structure and license fees, there's sufficient questions. I think we just move that bill forward to it outside the agency overview.
So, Mr. Rear, if we could pick up on the overview where we left.
Page 11 might be, before Dr. Carter leaves the table here, we might have a question or two about the economic impact relative to fish and wildlife users of the state. But these are figures that we have compiled from a number of documents that I've got here in front of me. If you're interested in seeing those at a later time, I can at least get the excerpts from where these figures came from. But it gives you an idea of what the economic impact is to the state of Oregon relative to sport fishing, hunting, commercial fishing, and wildlife watching. As you can see, the figures there show them as 1996, 7, and 8 figures. Those are the most recent figures we have that do this kind of modeling and analysis. So we can see that sport fishing is creating $305 million, hunting $315 million, and commercial fishing $175 million, wildlife watching $215 million. And it's interesting that probably the sport fishing, hunting, and commercial fishing side is probably declining at the same rate as wildlife watching is probably going up. I wouldn't say the same rate, but we're seeing an increase in that. And again, that gets back to some of the issues we had earlier on marketing, how we outreach to these folks that really appreciate fishing and wildlife in the state but don't really have a way to contribute to it. And that comes back to our general fund request of the governor's budget.
I think that 2 years ago I asked a similar question to this, but I'll try again. Commercial fishing number, of course, bothers me. How did you generate this number? Is that, I was taught the basic formula is 7-to-1 ratio and of income. So is that what you use?
No, basically we did this. I worked with a couple people who model, Hans Radke and Shannon Davis, who do commercial analysis of commercial fisheries. I work with them routinely every year. Basically, this number is the amount of personal income that's associated with commercial fish harvesting and processing, not including income returned by distant water fisheries. And basically, it's not, there's another measure that sometimes you call total economic output, or multiplier effect, and that's usually a much larger number. And that tends to measure the number of dollars that are stirred up in the economy as a whole in terms of numbers of transactions. This actually measures what goes into people's pockets. A couple of years ago, this number was, I think the last time this committee met on and saw some of these numbers, that commercial industry number was about $250 million.
I've got to ask a question. Why are you excluding the distant water fleet? Because if you're going to have a personal income number, even though we didn't land those fish into the state, there's still another $100 million there that you're not accounting for of dollars that came here, even though the fish were produced in another area.
Right, Mr. Chairman, Representative Thompson, you're exactly right in terms of the analysis. This number,
excuse me, could you repeat that? Representative Thompson, so seldom hears anybody say that he's exactly right. I'm really glad I wanted to say that.
The impact of the distant water fishery estimate, or recent estimate, in one of the series of reports that isn't in this package here, but I'd be glad to get a copy, was about $90 million. And it could be included. I didn't include it in this particular page because I was focused on fish harvest landed in the process in Oregon. But I think your point is well taken.
I appreciate the fact I can leave now. I think that, in my mind, that number should be added in here because it really is income to the citizens of the state of Oregon. And even though it's taken from the ocean, not directly under control of the state, it's still direct dollars here. I encourage you to put it back in next time.
Senator George, I hope for a second that you will not win.
Hey, when you win, why?
On the flip side of the commercial fishery maybe being below is the wildlife watching. How did you establish that number?
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, I actually took that out of some reports that were done. In 1996, the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Census Bureau did a survey of hunters and anglers and wildlife users, and that report is both the National Report and the Oregon Report are in that packet there. And then someone on the Fish and Wildlife Service staff used the estimates of wildlife watcher expenditures to estimate the personal income impact using what's known as the input-output model.
Interestingly, about half of those wildlife watchers that you see in the portion of the table above are from out of state, whereas on the hunting and fishing side, much lower proportion. We maybe have 20,000 non-resident hunters and more anglers, of course, because we sell a lot of daily licenses to non-residents. But basically, the numbers were generated by the people in the Fish and Wildlife Service.
Just follow up, Jim. That's good. I don't see that many people doing that activity, and I know that I may go down to the coast for a certain purpose, or I may go to the east side for a certain purpose, and I might view wildlife as part of that. What percentage of those activities that person who came to the state participated in were actually allocated to this number? I have a feeling it was a very high number.
I believe that, Mr. Chairman, Senator George, I believe that the way the survey worked is they asked people, did they travel a mile away or over a mile away from home to participate in this activity? So it could be a fairly short duration trip. The second thing they asked them was, is the primary purpose of your trip to do this wildlife watching or whatever? And so you're kind of relying on their responses to those questions. And given the number of people here that claim that they did these activities and the relative level of the impact, I would say that the impact per trip is substantially lower than for hunting and fishing.
I think Senator George touched on a question that I've always had. How many of the wildlife watchers are also hunters? And the fact is, that most folks do enjoy the sport of hunting for the whole experience, and they would report that seeing other wildlife besides the targeted game animals is part of the experience. Would we automatically count the 100-day trips as the wildlife watching experiences as well, famous fishers?
Mr. Chairman, I believe for purposes of the survey, they tried to prevent that from happening. I know they didn't count scouting trips, for example. But you're correct in your original comment that people who participate in these kind of activities, there are a lot of hunters that do that. And there's some data that shows kind of the overlap of the two or three different sportsmen and wildlife appreciators.
It means that Rustin Thompson and I can both leave today.
Yeah, I'm going to test my luck now. Seems to me that we're kind of comparing apples to oranges. Here you're talking about wildlife watchers and if they travel. And you're taking commercial fishermen and saying only the poundage and the dollars generated from it is all we're calculating in the commercial fishing industry. Yet I spend, in my own income, probably another $50,000 a year traveling, doing fisheries politics, doing things like that. And the industry isn't represented. I mean, we're comparing apples to oranges here. There's a lot of things that go on in the first fishing industry besides just personal income that's generated from it. You've incorporated in sport fishing and hunting and in watching, but you've left it out of that industry, and I'm having a little problem there, and that's all I'll say about it.
I got that, Representative Johnson, but your point's well made, and it's something we should be reminded of. I've got problems with the idea that watchable wildlife doesn't create the value added second and third and fourth, although there's a lot of expenditures that people that watch wildlife make, and it's travel and equipment and overnight stays and visitation. But the production of the hunting and fishing industries, there's a continuous hardware expenditure and license fees and some other stuff that is directly correlated to what the fourth that ends up at the agency. So.
Senator George, a little bit quickly, just measured in the commercial fishing fleet, was there any consideration there of the fact of how many people drive to our ports, like Newport, for example, to look at the ships in the bay and to watch them come and go and to watch the processing? That theoretically should be added to their category because that would be like the watching of the wildlife.
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, no, there's no inclusion of those items in there. No, that would be really interesting stuff to know. But I don't have any information.
Just for example, I mean, if you go to a port, what do you see? A shop filled with stores who are selling boats and pictures of ships in the harbor and that sort of thing.
I think if you just counted the number of people that go onto the docks, you have hundreds of thousands of day trips a season.
And if there were no ships in the bay, there would be no people coming to see that. Okay.
One of the things that we'll be exploring is the possibility of maybe if it might be reasonable or legal, if perhaps there might be 10 cents available from room tax that could go to ODF&W so that ODF&W can recapture some of the value it contributes to the process in terms of bringing people to do wildlife viewing and doing the resource process, et cetera. It might be worth exploring.
Anybody else want to jump on the recap?
I
think we want to go with that.
I see a lack of courage.
Chair, I think we can probably move through my overview. Well, so this is an individual thing, but the remainder of my overview is really focused on the dollar amount that we have seen in our past budget and what we're going to be what is being proposed to you in the governor's recommended budget. On pages 12, 13, and 14, we're going to get into just an overview of where the dollars are in our program on a very high level and how they're expended essentially by program. Maybe I don't want to get ahead of myself, but if we jump to the pie graph, so I don't have a lot of information I think that we haven't already discussed on page 12, but the pie charts on page 13 give you an idea of our three primary sources of income.
I'm going to lay a challenge for you.
Sure.
You have a first session today at 10. I'd like to call you to have at least 5 minutes to get to class. So what I'd like to do is have you get through and finish your overview through the wildlife vision presentation. Can you do that by show that you've got 10 minutes roughly?
No, I can.
Okay, sure. Let's go. Colleagues, I think that's a challenge for us.
These pie graphs just simply lay out, like I said, at a very high level. You can see that our federal funds are at 42%, 43% of our overall budget. General funds would increase slightly based on the governor's proposed budget to 10.5% of our overall budget. And then other funds, which we've already talked about, the different sources of other funds, totals approximately 46 or 47% of the agency's total budget. And then on the lower pie graph, we see how it's broken down by individual programs or divisions. We'll also see a breakdown of representative measure. We have some requests for information on FTE associated to these divisions, and we'll be able to get into those as we get into the division presentation. But rather than going into what you've got in front of you, I think I just moved to the next pie graph. I think these are just good reference documents for you to look at and maybe answer some of the questions that have already been presented. On page 14, the federal funds and where those funds come from, essentially. I mentioned earlier that we had quite a bit of income from BPA. That's almost 25% of the federal income. National Marine Fishery Service, 26%. And then it starts going down from there with, again, the tax revenue on, excise tax revenue on outdoor equipment, hunting and fishing equipment from the DJ funds at 11%, Pitt and Robinson funds at the top of the pie chart at 8%, and so forth. Many of those are associated to fisheries programs that we've already talked about, particularly along the Columbia River. The other funds on the lower pie graph there gives you an idea of where they all come from. The largest, of course, is the hunter and angler licenses and tag fees, which amount to about 69% of the total amount. There's a lot of miscellaneous funds that come in. The hydro fund creates about 1%. The commercial fisheries funds is approximately 3%. And then we are proposing, I think those lottery dollars are more proposed dollars in terms of Measure 66 funds that you'd see in the budget as we walk through it here in the next few days. On page 15, this is just simply a list of our legislative concepts that we proposed for the legislature this year. We've already talked quite a bit about House Bill 2100. That is the license and tag fee increase proposal, and it was referred to this committee. House Bill 2103 was a fish endowment fund. This was essentially sent back to the Water Committee. It currently funds at a level of about $171,000 a biennium, and this is half the interest off of our ending balance, or essentially our wildlife fund. And that's what was intended here was to try to get that balance up to about $3 million, and it's just not quite there yet. The next one is House Bill 2099, which amends license fees and definition of disabled persons. That has been signed by the governor, so that's gone through both houses and been signed. Essentially, it meets our requirements, our federal requirements of the Americans with Disabilities Act. House Bill 2101, the Fish Habitat Improvement Tax Credit. This has been referred to Revenue Committee with a due pass, from Revenue, excuse me, to House Water with a due pass recommendation. This is a tax credit for those that provide protection along riparian zones and provide habitat for both fish and wildlife species. There was a $100,000 credit cap in the prior bill that was sunsetting. The current bill is looking to increase that to $500,000. We're not sure if it's going to maintain that level. But that's essentially to continue that program on into the future and move that sunset date to a later time in 2004. House Bill 2102 is a carryover from last session. This is regarding fish passage. Essentially, it's been moved out of the Stream and Salmon Committee with a due pass to Ways and Means. What we've got here is a number of recommendations from the coalition that was put together over these last 2 years to look at what we could do to look at new projects primarily or improved projects for fish passage and see if there were ways to waive the requirement for fish passage if we could get proper mitigation. And then finally, in my overview, what you see before you on the next three pages, the next two pages essentially, is the agency's program option packages. And essentially, these program option packages implement all the changes to the agency's programs relative to the fee bill and the request for the general fund dollars. There's a few minor modifications here where we're adding or subtracting positions in dollars based on changes we've made in programs or required to do to move into this next biennium. I think we'll be getting into each one of these in much more detail as we walk through the budget, and we'll have a report from DAS essentially that covers these specifically, and I suggest maybe we can wait on that until we either get to a work session or we get to the DAS presentation itself. And then finally, we've got these two charts that give you an overview, a breakout by program of each division, essentially their primary program categories, and it shows the dollar amounts approved and the dollar amounts going forward to the governor's proposed budget and the FTE that are assigned to each one of those sub-programs. We could talk about those, but sure, we do have a few more minutes, so Mr. Chair, I'd essentially just open up for questions before we get to the Wildlife Division program discussion.
Questions for Greer?
Yes, if it's open.
Open.
We can go where you want now, I assume.
Sure.
I'm worried particularly about your relationship with state police. And I guess I'm looking over here at the governor's recommended budget. Tell me if I'm getting too close. You know, something that you can't say.
Sure.
But I'm worried about, at this number, where we are in the number of officers in Fish and Wildlife and what we need to do to comply with what National Marine Fisheries Service wants us to do. Could you react on where you're at and what you think National Marine Fisheries Service is going to require?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thompson, at this stage of the game, it's really hard for me to tell, I think for anybody to tell right now, what National Marine Fisheries Service is going to require of us to implement some of these take guidelines, proposed take guidelines, and protection criteria, and how those will be enforced. What we believe in terms of our budget is that what we have proposed in terms of the license fee increase and the general fund increase and the proposals that are in the increased funding for state police through the Measure 66 funds is that we would have their enforcement level back up to what its former level was up through the last biennium. There's also an enhancement package of an additional five officers there, and we believe in working with Captain Ball that we would probably have a sufficient breadth or depth of what we're looking for in terms of enforcement officers across the state to address a couple things. One is because we already moved a number of officers over to Western Oregon through the Oregon plan. We're already starting to get more
a focus on some of these issues that I'm sure National Marine Fisheries Service is going to be looking at in terms of protection standards for coho in particular, and these other species are being listed more recently. That did take a considerable movement, I think, of enforcement capabilities from Eastern Lake. And I think when Captain Barker did his presentation, and we have him solely on the docket here for you to speak to relative to our budget, I think you'll see that we've had some fall down now in terms of poaching and related activity on big game species in particular and other activities associated to hunting in Eastern Oregon. And this budget proposal would get us to those levels, I think, that both he and we feel would be adequate to get back to a level of enforcement that we could probably bring those complaint levels much higher than they've been in the past. The more difficult one to respond to, though, is the expectations of the National Marine Fisheries Service, because we simply don't have those yet.
Could I have one little follow-up? And I'll, and it, one of the things that disturbs me is we're asking for a hunting and fishing increase in fees. And yet, if I understand right, a lot of these officers which would traditionally be sent into the field for hunting and fishing law enforcement will now be shifted toward doing a lot more compliance with habitat and land use situations, which are not directly related to fishing. It seems like the shift would come, if we're going to have people doing that, that burden should be cost, should be either passed to the landowners or should be passed to general fund instead of the fishermen.
Mr. Chair, just as a response to that, I think the proposals that we have here relative to the lottery funds associated with Measure 66 money, it does get to that. It gets a little bit closer to that because it isn't direct funding from the license angler. So with the proposal that we have on the table, I think we can address some of those issues relative to where does the enforcement go and who's actually paying for that particular kind of enforcement.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This might be old news. I don't know, but it was in one of my files. I picked it up over the weekend. Your strategic operation plan update of March 1998 on page 3, and you probably don't have that in front of you, but speaks to management issues that you've dealt with, and it says that you were, the requirements have been dropped, including filling out landowner contact forms and monthly regional reports. And the second bullet point you have is that field staff, rather than headquarters staff, are charged with decision-making regarding building removal permits and local land use planning. And my concern is twofold. As we're trying to be more accountable and track what's going on with yours and other departments, it seemed odd to me that you're not keeping track of the contacts that your staff is making, number one. And I know other departments do this type of thing. It's not that burdensome. It's just a form that they fill out as they go through their day and or make check marks and then hand it in. And as far as the local staff doing the land and fill permits and land use planning issues, that makes a lot of sense to me if there's policy in place and oversight of those decisions. And if there's not, then I think that's where we get wound up in a lot of our issues such as Pony Creek and Milltown and some of those other issues where we end up in real wrestling matches that take years to sort out. I guess I'm interested in what your department is doing to make this process more efficient and how you're being more accountable about it.
Mr. Chair, some of our earlier discussions we've talked about taking the strategic plan to the next level. And through discussions I've had with commissions as well as other committees, I can bring forward some of those documents that we're going to be updating as well as creating some new policies and procedures relative to those very things you're talking about, particularly on the fill and removal. And then implementing what we've got here on the wall in terms of new watershed organization, and I think you'll see the accountability more at the local level. But I think you're absolutely right. Until those policies and procedures are in place, to show where the sideboards are for district fisher wildlife biologists to operate within. Make sure it's clear what our relationship is with those other state and federal agencies. There may continue to be some confusion about what their authority is and how much flexibility they really have in making that decision at the ground level. And we can certainly bring some of those back to you and show you the process for how we tend to create and finalize some of those policies into this next year.
And I think we'll want to talk about that more, but perhaps in a different venue. We've heard some of that at the RC committee, but we also need to possibly do a little maybe connection with our situation. Probably just a 5 minutes to the hour. We have a session at 10. What I'm going to do is have 15 minutes of discussion for today. We'll reconvene here tomorrow at the same time and pick up where we left off.
We just wanted to establish a date for
Pastor Greer.
Sorry. Is there a date for a public hearing? We did have a number of requests for you.
Mr. Chair, our intention is to go through division by division in the agency's budget and finish by next Wednesday. And we're planning to have, because of the interest in public testimony on this budget, we're planning to have a special time for that on next Tuesday, the 11th, from 1 to 4 o'clock in hearing room 50, I believe.
Any others? If no other issues to come to the committee, we're going to adjourn for today and reconvene tomorrow.